Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettina, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. I'm Dan Rettina, the founder of Dan's Papers, and my guest today is Tom Klavan, a well-known author who lives in the Hamptons and has been writing successfully great novels, one of which I'm particularly fond of, called Dark Noon, which we will talk about, and has a new book coming out, which is all about Indians. But let me ask a few questions. I've known you for many years. And
you'll regret, I'm sure.
Yes, I do. And you've been diligent as a writer. I was about 3 years ago or less, I was seeing you for the first time in bookstores in airports where books are listed in the top 20 books being sold and best-selling author. I'm very excited to know you and
thanks.
Been part of your journey. First of all, before we talk about what's coming up that you're doing, talk a little bit about Dark Noon. It had been a kind of secret story in the Hamptons that I had heard about, but no one ever wanted to talk about from the time I moved out here with my family as a teenager for the next 20 years. And then Tom wrote the book about it.
Yeah, that's a really good point that you made about people didn't want to talk about it. Dark Noon came out, I think it was in 2005, which was, 60-something years after the tragedy of the fishing boat Pelican. A fire, I think anybody else had been doing that book, say, in 1980 or in the 1990s. I don't know if they would have been able to talk to people because it was a very uncomfortable subject. I mean, just for your listeners who are not familiar with it, in September 1, 1951, the fishing boat Pelican went out with 65 passengers, got caught in a storm, came back with, I think, only 19 survived. So I think I was fortunate in my timing that, 50 years later, the people who were still around who I wanted to interview about the Pelican were willing to talk about it. And what I think really helped inform the book was a lot of these eyewitness accounts.
Well, it was a time right after the Second World War when a big military facility on Fort Pond Bay in Montauk turned into a fishing boat community called Fish Shangri-La, which had another its own story. And they were taking out fishermen who would come out on the railroad on a special train just before dawn on a particular weekend at night. And there were about 30 Montauk boats there, I think, in the fishing fleet, the stock. And one of them went out and almost more than half the people on board died of a big wave that came and washed over the boat and turned it upside down. It's an astonishing story, and you told it. And at that point, I'd been running the newspaper for 20 years or 30 years, and I'd never been able to find out what had happened until I read your book. And that's how I came to know you.
Yeah, I'm glad to say that every few weeks, really, even to this day, it's been 21 years since the book was published. Every few weeks, I encounter somebody who's discovering it for the first time, which is not easy because it's out of print. From the original printing is over. So it's really gratifying that people are still discovering the book and want to talk to me about it. If I can mention something real quickly, the Montauk Historical Society is planning to reissue the book, Dark Noon, a 75th anniversary edition, because this September 1 is the 75th anniversary of the Pelican disaster. And I've given the rights to the book to the Montauk Historical Society, so they're going to reprint it and keep all the proceeds, if there are any proceeds, if anybody still buys it. But I think it's a story that people still want to hear about.
Yes. When did you first start writing books and these historical novels? Well, they're not novels. They're actually corrected events for many, many of your books.
Right. I was, as you know, I was in the newspaper business for quite a while, and I was starting to write books on the side and trying to get them published. I originally was writing novels. I couldn't get anything published. My first book was published, nonfiction book was published in 1993, where I was the co-author of a book called Raising the Rainbow Generation. And that sort of opened the door for me, got me one of the most important things, as you know, in the business, an agent. And once I had an agent, somebody who's going to represent me, it made it a lot easier for me to find other writing gigs.
Yeah. Were you born and raised out here or moved out here? How'd you get around out?
I was born in the Bronx, and my family moved out of the Bronx in the 60s, and I grew up in a town called Deer Park here on Long Island. But I didn't come out to Sag Harbor, which has been my home now till February of 1982, so I've lived over 44 years.
And you write all of Steinbeck, like right in a writing room at your house?
That's where I am right now, my upstairs, and I write 364 days a year. I try and take Christmas off.
How many books have you written? And
I copped a 25 book. I don't know the exact number, but I 25 is my story, and I'm sticking to it.
what's the most popular of the books that you've written?
The most popular book, the one that sold the most that I've written or co-written, is called The Heart of Everything That Is, which I wrote with my friend Bob Drury. Came out in 2013. It's still selling, still get royalty checks twice a year. At last look, it's sold about 350,000 copies. That's been the most successful. The most successful of my solo books is a book called Dodge City, which came out in 2017.
What is the book that you mentioned that you partnered with? What was it about?
The Heart of Everything That Is the story of Red Cloud, the chief of the Lakota Sioux tribe in the 1850s and 1860s. It's the story of Red Cloud's War, which is actually the proper title. There was a war called the Red Cloud's War. 1866 to 68 was the only war that the U.S. government lost, where the U.S. government sued for peace for it was beaten by an Indian tribe.
Where was this?
Mostly South Dakota, some North Dakota, some Wyoming, some Colorado, but mostly set in the plains areas of the United States.
What were some of the actions that occurred in the war?
The main action, there were several skirmishes between the U.S. Army cavalry and the Lakota Sioux and their allies, the Cheyenne. But the biggest event was called the Fetterman Massacre, which is December 1866. A large army of Indians led by Red Cloud and Crazy Horse attacked a fort in South Dakota, excuse me, in Wyoming. And when the Captain Fetterman led troops, 81 troops out to chase down the Indians, he was caught in an ambush and completely wiped out. So it's one of those few examples. It was sort of like a Custer's last stand before there was a Custer's last stand.
Well, this was a year after the end of the Civil War.
Yes, it was. And Civil War ended. What that resulted in, one of the things that resulted in, is that there was this fresh emphasis on moving people west and establishing forts.
Is that when the Indian Wars began? Is that, would you say that?
Well, the Indian Wars have been going on for centuries already by then. They just kept moving farther west. So I guess you could say the final phase of the Indian War began right after the Civil War, leading up to the Massacre at Wounded Knee in 1890.
Tell me about your most recent book that you have written and what's upcoming.
Well, the most recent book is called Vengeance, The Last Stands of Custer, Crazy Horse, and Sitting Bull. It's just been published to coincide with the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Little Bighorn. The story is not just Custer's, but it's also a story of the Indian side of things, how the Custer's last stand was a last stand for them too. And then I have a book coming out in October called The Phantom, The American Marine the Nazis Could Not Kill. It's about this Marine Corps officer who's a super spy, super saboteur, who was dropped behind enemy lines in France in 1944 and rallied the French resistance to defeat the Nazis.
What got you interested in writing historical novels like this?
Begun when I was a kid because I loved history right from the start. I loved reading about it. I loved watching movies about American history, TV shows. And so I just got very lucky that I was able to make a living doing something I was so interested in.
When did you first come out to Sag Harbor?
The exact date was February 1, 1982.
And what brought you out here, and what did you think about it when you first saw it?
First saw it, it was covered in snow. It was January, a few weeks before I moved out here. And my wife and I were living in New York for a couple of years, and we wanted to get out of New York. And we were actually trying to check out East Hampton, but the snowstorm started. We only got as far as Sag Harbor. And there was a man there named Carl Marino, who was a real estate agent at Harbor Cove Realty. We encountered him in his office. He was just leaving. He said, "I'll show you a house that's for rent." He showed it to us. We rented it. It was a three-bedroom ranch near Long Beach, and it went for $400 a month.
That's a lot of money.
Those days, yeah, 82.
Yeah. What did you like about being out here? Had you been coming out here before that?
I had never seen Sag Harbor before. One of my favorite authors was John Steinbeck. When I read about Steinbeck, I knew he had spent a number of years living in Sag Harbor, so that intrigued me. But I didn't really know much about the area. This maybe was before they started calling it the Hamptons. I don't know. I was not familiar with it. I'd never been out here before, so it was kind of an adventure. When you're in your 20s, you can do things like that.
What in particular did you like about it? Well, a lot of the houses out here at that time, I think, were still abandoned from that period.
Well, I think that was one of the things that appealed to me was that not abandoned houses, but that it was a small town that was quiet. After living in the city, that's exactly what I was looking for.
What had you been doing before you took up writing and when you came out here?
I got my first job in book publishing, working for the Guinness Book of World Records as a proofreader and copywriter. It's a pretty crazy place because people would show up to, like, showing us up their potty trained iguanas, for example. So it's kind of a crazy place. I enjoyed it, made a lot of good friends there. But again, we wanted to leave the city.
You wanted to get out east or somewhere. Did you look at other locations?
Well, not seriously. Really was a fast decision. We came out here in a snowstorm, rented the place, and said, we'll move out here and see what it's like. That was 44 years ago.
Yeah. Had you been interested in another kind of career other than writing before you settled on being a writer?
Well, I was in journalism, writing and reporting for different publications. And I think that would have been fun indefinitely. But I didn't get these opportunities to write books.
Did you study this in school and did you go to college and stuff? Are you an English major?
Yes, I was. But doesn't really prepare you for much of anything. So a lot of it was working at it over and over and over again, every day. I think the best recipe for a writer is just write every day.
How much time do you spend every day writing in your routine?
I'm an early morning writer. I usually get to my desk about 7:30, and I'll write all morning. The afternoon is devoted to appointments, research, whatever else I need to do. Then I'll go back to work about 6 until about 8. And I do that every day. Try and do it half a day on Sunday. That's my lifestyle. That's what I enjoy. It's not like I'm punching a clock, not like I'm working at a job that I don't like. It's the job I love,
Yeah.
more than just a job. So I do it every day.
When did you discover laptops?
Well, I still haven't. This is I borrowed from my wife. I use her laptop when I do interviews. I don't own one.
I remember how it was so much easier to work using a laptop than just a typewriter. I mean, that was a stunning discovery,
It was. I never made that transition because I guess I'm just more comfortable with a desktop keyboard and a setup, so I stick to it.
Sure, but I guess I'm talking about like Microsoft Word as opposed to typewriter.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That was an astonishing moment in my life
Yeah.
to discover I didn't have to use whiteout anymore.
Whiteout, yeah. You don't have to mimeograph anything either.
Do you have any plans for anything further beyond what you just described as the new Indian book coming out?
Well, like I say, in October, I have the book called The Phantom with Bob Drury coming out. And I'm working on another American West book that has to do with Billy the Kid. But I'm so early in the process, maybe I don't have much to talk about it yet.
Well, thanks for being on the podcast and I hope you feel better was one thing.
Yeah, it's not just me. There's something going around that's really affected people and a
Yeah.
respiratory issue, and it just lingers.
And you were honored by the New York Press Association this year as the best columnist, I believe.
That was a very pleasant surprise. I didn't even know that my column for the Express News Group was being entered. I was quite shocked when I got notified that I'd won. But I figured I'd given it to everybody else. And I was the only one left they hadn't yet given it to.
Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.